Hello, world. This is Allison Pipitone. In this podcast, we talk about music and those of us who do it for a song. Welcome to The Great Unsung. Robbie Konnikoff, it's me, Al Pipitone. How are you?
I'm doing great. It's good to see you today.
When I was setting up, I said, Robbie, I brought two Gatorades. Do you want one? He goes, oh, I usually drink water, but I drink Gatorade on certain occasions. And I said, really? What kind of occasions is that? And you said, well, when there's no water. See, that's the kind of thing. Like, I've talked to a bunch of people and about you, and you have these witticisms. You give the coolest advice in a way that you have to think about later. Like Mark Hunt used one of your quotes when he was describing the art of being a good recording engineer. So already, you've already made an appearance on this show, Robbie.
Okay.
That reminds me. I can tell you that you have been a mentor to so many people. Like your name, I've known you for probably 20 years, and through those years, your name often comes up, and in a way that the word I hear so often is mentor, okay? I want to ask you, how did you find yourself in that role?
Oh, that's a very good question. I don't consider myself a mentor, quite frankly, but I'll reflect back on when I was a young budding music person that on occasion I'd run into people such as Tommy Calandra, who had the Buffalo Music College of Knowledge. He had a recording studio. He was a brilliant guy. He was the bass player in the seminal band Raven from Buffalo. And he was very encouraging to aspiring engineers, musicians, and so on. There were people like, I remember the owner of the studio out in Clarence, Mark Studios. Mm-hmm. Mark Moret, who owns and runs the studio. His dad, Vince Moret, was the guy who started that studio. And there was another guy that just was so encouraging and would open their, you know, his door to get anyone who had passion, to give them an opportunity. So those are mentors.
So I guess what that was you paid attention and you realized how much of an impact that had on you, those kinds of people and the opportunities they gave you or the encouragement they gave you. So you sort of passed the torch. Would you say that?
Not consciously, okay, but I certainly, over the years, would, and you brought up Mark Hunt, who I knew as an intern. He was an intern where I was working at the time. There were a number of these guys. Mike Rorick, another guy.
Yep.
He started out as an intern. Mm-hmm. And if anyone wants to waste their time coming in and sitting and talking with me, I'll pay attention. But when people are as passionate, I remember the first day a guy came into the studio and for whatever reason came to sit down and talk to me and told me that he used to be a truck driver and he hurt his back. And his wife said, well, you write some interesting songs, Tom. And that person is Tom Stahl.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay.
And who now, when I think of the great songwriters in the world, and there's obviously a whole bunch of them, the Lennon and McCartneys, and go down the list. Well, to my spirit, Tom Stahl's definitely one of the top ones.
I hear you. I agree with you. And so there's a case where he came in, I know Tom, and he was really shy about performing and recording and believing in himself in the beginning. So between Lou and you, I think you just nudged him in to give them that start. I really think that's true.
Well, you know, there have been occasions I try to be very encouraging, especially to, you know, the younger people, to believe in themselves, as you just said, and to, you know, follow their heart. It's also got me into trouble sometimes.
Okay, let you tell me why, because I could guess, but I would.
Well, going back a number of years, you know, you get phone calls, and sometimes the person on the other side may not know what the business is, and they perhaps confuse a recording studio with being a record label. Mm-hmm. On occasion, you know, people would send, well, way back when it was cassettes and then CDs and so on. I got a phone call a number of years ago from a young lady in Connecticut, and she had sent me a cassette and called me back. What did I think of it? I said, well, you know, I think it sounds great, and I can tell that you're very passionate about what you're doing, you know, and follow your heart. And she said in the conversation, well, if I took a train from Connecticut down to New York, could I come see your studio? And she goes, how would I get there from
Penn Station?
Yeah, from Penn Station. And I said, well, it's really simple. You'd make a right turn and go about 427 miles. You know, just joking around. Well, I'll be darned if about 2 weeks later, there's a knock at the studio door, and it's this young girl from Connecticut. I don't think she walked. You know, she certainly didn't drive, but showed up at the studio. That can get you in trouble.
Oh, my gosh. No. Okay. How old was she? Was she like in her 30s or 20s or teens?
She was in her teens.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, what do you do in that case?
Well, in that particular case, we call, like, I don't know what the crisis services was, because she didn't have anywhere to stay. And, you know, I was just in shock when all of a sudden I opened up the door. And
there she was.
Yeah, and I didn't even know who it was. Said, can I help you?
So you learned a very important lesson, which is, like, don't joke with people on the phone or ever, right? Oh, my gosh. I want to talk about music through the decades. So let's go back. I guess when you were a little boy, was music important in your world?
Music was very important as a little boy. You know, part of my family was very musical. But my whole world changed, as so many of a number of other people here, there, and everywhere. You know, the night those four guys were on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
So you were looking forward to it. You've been hearing about the Beatles.
Oh, yeah.
And then what happened when you saw them? What did you feel?
Well, you know, it was kind of like a world-changing thing. But it also was the beginning of, like, I want to be involved in something like that. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have the patience nor the skill set to play music. So
is that true? So you didn't?
I didn't play anything.
Okay.
So my journey into music began with wanting to be a recording engineer.
So you said, all right, I'm gonna get involved with music. So here you are, a young kid in Buffalo. You hear the Beatles. You sort of know this world is out there. And you say, I want to be in that world, right?
Well, yeah. So at that point, I'm pretty young in 1964. But soon after that, the teen dances, going out to the Boulevard Cave and seeing some of the bands in Buffalo. You know, back in the mid to late 60s, you could go to, like, the Brighton Golf Course and get something called a sheriff's card. So I think I was probably 14 at the time, or 15, and got this sheriff's card that said I was 18. So that allowed me, and I wasn't the only one. Well, you know, all the kids would then go into the various clubs in the area to watch music, you know, beyond the teen clubs.
Mm-hmm. How exciting was that time? Like,
it was everything.
Yeah, I think we're a little bit, I want to say, oversaturated with that now. Like, it's a different feeling. Like, when you went there to hear the bands, and you were part of this live moment that was so energized, right? Like, it must have been really cool.
Well, it was very cool. And, you know, I always refer to it as like the high priests of Buffalo music. So I'd go in and watch bands like Raven, watch bands like Stan Celeste. And I mean, these folks had such an impact on my musical life, for sure.
Mm-hmm. And so was there a sense of community? Like, did you start working with them and recording with them at that time, or how'd that work?
Well, once again, I'm still a teenager going to high school.
Mm-hmm.
After I graduated from high school and ended up going to a couple recording programs, went to a place called the Institute of Audio Research in New York City for recording engineering. And then subsequently went out to Olympia, Washington, that had an experimental college called the Evergreen State College. It was an experimental school. It had a recording studio in the basement, and you developed your own program. Kurt Cobain went there, obviously not when I was there, but it gave me an opportunity to learn the craft enough.
It was hard to physically find the equipment that you could practice on, right? Is that true?
Well, yeah. In other words, when I first started interning, if you will, when I eventually came back to Buffalo, and we're talking now in the 70s, the early 70s, you know, there may have been three or four recording studios in the city. Not a lot.
Were a lot of people wanting to record? So, like,
yeah, there was an interest, absolutely.
So it was like buzzing, right?
Yeah, and were not recording at home. You know, we didn't have that technology. You know, now what you can go to Sweetwater Guitar Center and pick up for $800 would have cost you $250,000 back at that time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was a lot more community because of that.
Mm-hmm. You know, I remember back in the day that there was this huge debate about analog versus digital. And that was sort of when I got into the music field, right? And so I remember people, you know, really discussing it, arguing about it, having strong opinions about it. And it kind of reminds me of now. Like, you know how people say recording at home versus recording in the studio? Like, so this is nothing new. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely, I'd agree with it. You know, I'm surrounded by recording engineers, many of which perhaps graduated from places like Fredonia. Mm-hmm. And there's so many other programs now, great programs, Entrep. There's online programs and so on. Well, a lot of these, my friends, engineering friends, are what I call recording snobs. Okay, and they'll talk about all kinds of technical stuff. And to me, it's always the one consistent thing to me is that it's a business of songs and in playing, as opposed to technical stuff in terms of, you know where I'm going?
I do know, because I've worked with both kinds of engineers, and there are some recording engineers who really don't care. They consider sound in a different way from how we consider sound. I think you and I are simpatico on that. Like, if you get a good performance, the technical aspects can be a little bit funky. Do you agree?
Totally.
But if I work with somebody who's the opposite side of the coin, and I have, it's just like a recipe for disaster.
It can be, you know, it can be. the technology today is so accessible that the biggest artist in the world, perhaps today, is Billie Eilish, who won all four major awards at last Sunday's Grammys, that, you know, has 9 billion listens on Spotify. And she did her record with her brother, Phineas, in a bedroom at their parents' house. She sat on her bed to do all the vocals. So
I guess.
So there you go.
You're right. That's like, there are no rules.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also kind of like heresy in a way that a studio owner is saying, well, do it in your bedroom.
Yeah, actually, that's a good point. You're right. How can you say that? How dare you?
Well, you know, but they didn't use drum sets and things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
So an environment like the studio is obviously more conducive. Also, not everyone has the engineering and production skills of Billie's brother, Phineas.
That's true.
You know, he's ridiculous. So, and then there's other musicians who will choose to come into the studio because they want to play and sing, and they don't want to be getting distracted in terms of engineering.
Correct, because there are so many variables.
Yeah.
You know, you're right. So I guess it's such a unique thing, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's an individual thing, and there's no one right or no one wrong.
Mm-hmm. We talked a little bit ago about your cousin, Sandy Konnikoff, and his drumming skills, phenomenal, right? And you said he played with Bob Dylan on the electric, he went electric tour?
Yeah, the first tour when Bob Dylan got tomatoes thrown at him. This is with the band.
His fans turned on him, basically.
Well, he was a folk music god. So when he came out with the band doing electric stuff, they were infuriated.
Did you ever see him live?
Bob Dylan?
Yeah.
Yes.
You did?
Oh, yeah.
I have not, and I wish I did. I saw a video of him playing with that electric band, and they sounded great. And the audience was like booing him. And I was like, are you kidding me?
Well, that's why Levon Helm, the drummer, left the tour. It was.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. So that's why Sandy, who knew those guys, because they all used to play with Ronnie Hawkins up in Toronto, got the phone call and met him out in San Francisco and played for 4 or 5 months with him. And then he left the tour before they went to England.
Okay. I want to ask you about your time at Moog, right? How did that come about?
I was working at Select Sound Recording Studios, which at the time was in Bill Cothan's mother's basement.
Oh.
Okay.
Okay.
And worked with Bill and Dick Bowerly.
Mm-hmm.
And had a lot of very great experiences over there, learned a lot, got to record a number of my heroes, if you will.
Really, such as?
Steve Nathan, Gary Malibur, think guys like that.
Mm-hmm, right.
Some of the high priests, if you will. Well, one of our clients was Moog Music, and we made a series of demonstration cassettes for the company. So they would bring over a new instrument like the Micromoog, and they'd play it, we'd record it, and then we would duplicate, you know, their cassettes so they could send them out to the dealers and so on.
Gotcha. So they were trying to sell the new instruments, basically.
Yeah.
That was their way of distributing and letting people hear the sound
before
the internet.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, gotcha.
Exactly. The marketing manager at the time seemed to like the way I dealt with people. And Moog was going through some changes, and this is like 1977 maybe. And the changes were, Moog was owned by a company called Norlin. Norlin at the time was the world's largest musical instrument corporation. They owned Moog. They owned Gibson.
Oh my gosh.
They owned Pearl Drums.
Oh my gosh.
Lowry Organ, Story and Clark Piano, the Brass Olds Company. It was a huge musical instrument corporation.
Yeah.
So Norlin had sales reps that would go to the music stores to sell their stuff. Synthesizers back at that point were a little bit more, you needed, these guys didn't, the sales team didn't even know how to turn on the instrument, let alone explain it.
Really?
So Moog decided they were gonna have a dedicated sales force to go to the stores to demonstrate the instruments as well as sell them.
Okay.
And they also had, they hired me to become the artist relations director specifically for Moog.
So because they liked your people's skills and they liked the way you explain things, did you understand like the technology of it back then? Were you good at that?
No.
Really?
Yeah, I wasn't. But I was lucky that I always try to surround myself with friends who, if I don't know about something, they do. Mm-hmm. And I had a couple friends initially when I took the job. I moved out to Los Angeles because there's obviously a bunch of prominent people out there to go visit. And I met a young guy named Rory Kaplan, who, nicest guy in the world, who knew the technology, plus he was a great player. And Rory would accompany me when I had appointments. He would demonstrate, and I would just get to sit there and smile.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, it was.
The perfect supervisor role, right?
Yeah, right.
Okay. Did I hear that you worked with Devo back in that era?
Oh, yeah.
Really? Because that was their thing, right? Using, what were they like?
Really, really nice guys. Mark Mothersbaugh, who to me was always the leader of the band, visionary leader, I mean. They were really nice to work with.
They were seen as so out there back then. I literally remember watching them on Saturday Night Live once when I was a little girl, and they scared me. Yeah. I got scared, right?
I understand. One of my favorite experiences, and this speaks loudly about the Moog synthesizer in terms of who it appealed to. Because after my LA thing, I moved back to Buffalo and worked out of the Moog factory on Walden Avenue. But one of my favorite experiences was that we had two, let's call it demonstration rooms. And one day I had the guys from Devo in one room, and Oscar Peterson, the other.
Oh my gosh, are you serious?
Very serious.
In Buffalo?
In Buffalo. Oh yeah, there were a lot of, you know, prominent people that would come in, if you will.
That's amazing. And how long did you have that gig for?
I left Moog, I believe, 1985. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to go down with the ship because it was evident that what was going to happen, they were going out of business. So I jumped before I had to do the Titanic
thing. All right, good for you. Women and children and recording engineers first, right? question. Some people describe music as a job, a career, a lifestyle, or a life. Which would you put yourself in? Which category?
Well, let me say something the way I explain it, I've always said to people, I can't tell you how fortunate I feel personally, because I don't remember once, not one time, ever waking up and feeling like I was going to work.
Wow. Seriously?
Seriously.
That is huge.
Yeah. So that's why I try to inspire, not so much try to inspire, but when you see passion in someone that, you know, for music, it's like, well, you know, there's different doorways that open up. You know, it doesn't have to be this one thing. Mm-hmm. You know, there can be other ways to be involved and, you know, follow your heart.
You can't ever talk about a life in music without talking about the financial aspect of it. Like, I think you can't be consumed with material things if you want to be in this business. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
Did you ever find it hard or a struggle in that sense?
Not so much so that it would...
Like it wouldn't deter you.
Right.
So your values were in being happy. And that's actually a huge gift if a person can wake up every day and not feel bad about going to work or not feeling like it is work.
Well, yeah. And I mean, there's always exceptions in the sense that if I had a family and needed to provide, that may have changed perhaps some of my decisions or pursuits.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. That's, in fact, what Gray said. I interviewed Gray Howes, who you know.
Yes.
He talked about his dad was a cornet player.
Yes.
And his dad, there was a whole gap in him playing when the kids came along, when he got married and had kids, because if you're doing it right, you pay attention to that and you have
Absolutely.
To provide, right?
Yeah, so, you know, in my situation, as long as my dog has food in his bowl
mm-hmm.
at the beginning and the end of the day, I'm kind of like happy. I'm fine.
I'm with you on that. There is definitely room for dogs in the music industry, right? One more point I want to talk about. I just want to get your feedback on this. 5% of all recording engineers and producers are women. 95% are men. And I thought back to my own recording career, and I've probably worked with, I would say, 20 different people at least. And I had one woman engineer when I was in New York City once. And I remember thinking, that's awesome. And I was just watching. I'm like, she's doing such a good job. But I find it very unfortunate that that's true. Like, what do you think about that? Can you comment on that concept?
That's a disturbing number, obviously.
Yeah, in 2020 still.
There's no rhyme or reason. I mean, you take a look at it, an artist like Linda Perry,
mm-hmm.
who not only one of the great songwriters, but one of the great producers in mm-hmm. today's music.
You know, the technology part of it, like, I'm generalizing, but I do think it's true that women have not been encouraged to get involved with the physical recording aspects of it, the working the machines, the being at the helm, being in the driver's seat, really, when it comes to that. And they might not feel comfortable making the call and stepping in. And I think there should be more opportunities created because they aren't there now. Do you know what I mean?
I do. I certainly do.
Have you ever worked with a second engineer or anything? Have you ever worked with women, like producers or engineers?
There have been sessions in New York and L.A.
Mm-hmm.
where there were women involved. I don't recall if they were producers,
mm-hmm.
but certainly engineers.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, there's some extremely successful women engineers or producers.
Mm-hmm.
But the numbers are just not there to support it in terms of the big picture, I guess.
Yeah, I just found that fact really interesting and a little bit unsettling. And then I started thinking about it. I'm like, you know what? In my own life, that's actually been true, you know? Do you still encourage people to get into this field?
Absolutely.
Everything is so segmented and the income streams are so challenged now as far as streaming goes and things like that. And it also, because everyone can do it, everyone is doing it, right? And it's such a busy field, right? Why do you think it's still important for people to pursue music?
It's important if their heart aches for it, if it's a part of them that, I don't know if it's right professionally for everyone, but I think that sometimes we have in our mind what we want to do, but perhaps we're not given the opportunity to explore something that we're not thinking of.
Hi, everyone. This is Sophia Alteri.
And I'm Aaron Fern.
And today, we will be introducing our next segment on the infamous Edie Lehman Boedeker. Edie Lehman Boedeker was born on September 25th, 1957 in Buffalo, New York. She was known to be an American singer, vocal contractor, vocal producer, and conductor. She was also known for her work on many roles, such as Solo, A Star Wars Story in 2018, Hidden Figures in 2016, and Tag in 2018. So why don't we talk about those following movies? Aaron, have you seen any of those movies?
Yes, I have. I've seen Solo, Star Wars Story. I'm a very big Star Wars fan. And the different genres of music thrown into this movie were very emotional, and they brought out the emotion of the film. As a Star Wars fan, the music is always super important to the outcome of the film and how the audience perceives the film, and I think that they did a very good job, and Edie was a part of that with her vocal backing tracks as well as producing the vocals for it. I've seen Hidden Figures and Tag, but I'm more familiar with Tag, and Tag was more of a fun, lighthearted movie as compared to A Star Wars Story and Hidden Figures, and I think that she did a very good job with that as well.
I was more, I believe, more familiar with Tag and Hidden Figures. I did not see Solo, A Star Wars Story, but I plan on to. I believe that Hidden Figures was such a very powerful movie depicting women working for NASA, and having Edie as the vocal background and producer for it, I think just really accentuates more the premise of the story, especially regarding women in that industry. And with Tag, I did like how it was very lighthearted and comedic between a bond of friends, childhood friends. And it actually surprised me that she was a session singer for that, and she was a part of the producing as well. So her accolades go far beyond those, however. At the beginning of her career, she began as a classical pianist. Her first job in the film industry was Xanadu, where she was a featured vocalist. And from there on, she received her biggest job offer up until that point for the show Full House. At the age of 7, she moved out to LA and remained a citizen ever since, creating a career out of not being the lead singer in a band or project, but instead a large catalog of movies and session recordings.
Since then, Edie has recently been elected to the Board of Governors of the Recording Academy Los Angeles chapter, the membership organization behind the Grammy Awards.
Thank you for listening to our introduction. Now here is Allison Pipitone.
I'll tell you something. It's interesting. There's a woman from Buffalo, and I never knew she was from Buffalo. Her name is Edie Lehman Boedeker. And I just had a great conversation with her about a week ago. I was very aware of her. She's a session singer and a vocal contractor. And extremely successful. She was born in Buffalo and moved with her family when she was 7 or 8 years old out to California. She's a classically trained pianist. That's what she first did. She was telling me last week that she played at Kleinhans Music Hall when she was 5 years old.
Oh, my gosh.
Do you ever watch Pensado's Place?
No.
Okay. Well, the engineers still, okay?
Okay.
It's really interesting. I'll give you the links.
Okay.
But to make a long story short with Edie, I watched a Pensado's Place thing, and she was saying that sometimes a singer will think in terms of, I want to be the lead singer in a band. And if that doesn't work out, that doesn't mean that there isn't a career there. She's created that for herself. Mm-hmm. Okay, if I showed you the list of films that she's done and the vocal contractor, and You won't believe it.
Wow.
Okay. And in this interview, Dave Pensado was saying, well, did you go on tour with many bands? She goes, well, I'm a session singer. You don't go out on the road when you're a session singer because someone will step in and take your place. She goes, I only would go out with two artists. One was Quincy Jones. The other was Aretha Franklin.
Holy macanoli. Are you kidding me? Jesus, really?
Yeah. But to hear her talk, you know, because he was saying, well, what advice do you give your singer, you know, singers? She goes, got to read music. You know, because he said, well, when you're doing a vocal session, do you guys rehearse against the track? He goes, no. You read the charts because time is money, okay? And also had some great advice in terms of your spirit and your social skills. He said you may be in a choir. Well, you know, there's got to be a group feeling because the person next to you may be someone who's in charge of the next session. If you're a bit of a jerk, you're not going to get the phone call.
Absolutely.
You know, so common sense, things of that nature.
I think, like, what I'm hearing you say is, first of all, you know, she was a classically trained pianist. Maybe she at one point wanted to be like the front person, but maybe when those doors weren't opening, she said, what are my skills and where can I find my niche? And so I feel like that's what you encourage in people as well, right? Like,
well, maybe that's why when I heard her, you know, in this interview, that's why maybe I'm rooting on the sideline going, yeah, that's it. I relate to that. That's important. It's real important. And I think it goes along with whatever the case may be, singers or engineers in the recording engineering field. There's all kinds of stuff going on now if you know that technology. Okay. Sound effects for games. Okay. It doesn't have to be just one thing. You've just got to open up the universe and say, well, I've got these skill sets and let's pursue this or that or the other thing.
Did you ever have a situation where the doors were closed in front of you and you kept open-minded for like, okay, what else can I do? Did you ever find yourself in that situation?
Yeah, sure. You know, I will say one thing to close the book on Edie Boddicker.
Yeah.
You know, if you're watching the Grammys on Sunday, she was the one that was conducting the choir for Billie Eilish's performance.
Seriously?
Seriously.
You were just talking to her last week, Robbie?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Good for you. See, you get around. You talk to a lot of people. Sometimes I come in and you're on the phone. Who knows who you're talking to?
I'm mostly talking to, like, dog food companies or something.
All right, Robbie, thank you so much for your time today. I know that we have a lot that we love. Music, we have that in common. Dogs, we have that in common. How are your doggies doing? Do you have one dog now?
I have one dog.
What's
now.
What's his name?
Spats.
And what kind of dog is he?
English Mastiff.
And how much does he weigh?
About 200 pounds.
Unbelievable.
He's a couch potato.
Love it.
Yeah.
Did you say Spats?
Yes.
Love that name. He's a lucky dog.
Like I tell people, one of the goals in my life is to be half the person my dog thinks I am.
And we're going to end it on that.
Okay.
I'm sure you are, Robbie. Okay. You're half the person your dog. No, you're more than half. I'm going to put you at 85%. Thanks, Robbie.
Thank you.
And there you have it, folks. What a pleasure and honor it was to speak with Robbie Konnikoff. He is such an important figure in the Buffalo music scene. He has supported and encouraged countless musicians, including myself. And I'm so happy he told me and us about Edie Lehman Boddicker. I did not know her before this, and it turns out she's amazing. Another person we can proudly say was born in Belo. The Buff. Talking proud. and of course, also thank you and a big shout out to my students, Sophia Alteri and Aaron Fern, for giving us a little more information about Edie and for editing and producing this episode. Aaron and Sophia are music industry students at the State University of New York at Fredonia. Thank you for listening, and please send us your comments or your questions to thegreatunsung@gmail.com. Until next time, this is Allison Pipitone signing off.